Blog Talk Radio.
Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media. You can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your world, in your life, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing tonight?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing good. I'm excited about the show. We covered a much-needed topic last week, but, I don't know if it's quite as much fun as talking about stuff that really fires us up.
Well, We're bouncing back from next week. We have a contractual obligation with our audience to spend 20% of our time talking about the risks, talking about the downsides, and the rest of the time we get to have fun talking about what we like talking about, which is how awesome things can be. And that's what we're gonna do tonight. We're gonna talk about how good it can get. Before we delve into that, anything interesting going on in your life you want to share with us this evening?
Man, I just discovered a website that I wanted to share with you and everyone else. Kindle Buffet. I know you're big into Kindle now, Phil.
Yes, I am.
You've gotten to where you do not even – I mean, you have paper books on your shelf that you go and buy the Kindle version now because you'd rather read it that way. That's how big
exactly.
into Kindle you are. And I'm,
so I can always have it with me. That's right.
Exactly. You can carry it around.
Yep.
And I've gotten that way myself, and so this website Kindle Buffet is nothing but free books on Kindle, and every day it's a new batch of free books, and it's not a small batch. I'm talking like it might be, a dozen to 20 books that are free, and most of them are very positively reviewed, and it runs the gamut. There's a lot of stuff I have no interest in reading at all, but nearly every day there's going to be something that's interesting and which gives me a lot more reading material than I ever have time to actually read, but it's pretty cool. And it focuses just on the free stuff. So Kindle Buffet.
Very cool. All right. Well, I've got to check that out. That sounds,
I guess that's my public service announcement for tonight.
Well, that's a good one. And speaking of public service announcements, I just somehow leaped right to the fact that we need to get an update from our friends in New Jersey who have a new World Transformed related. It was Fast Forward Radio when they started it. Related science and technology group. Going. Speaking of acting in the public interest, we want to make sure that we have another discussion around that here in the near future and talk about how people can get their own groups going. It was just a random synapse. When you said public service announcement, Stephen, it reminded me that that's something that we need to that we need to be talking about. And I've got a big rant I want to do about Maker's Mark, but I've decided, in the interests of we've got so many positive topics to talk about this evening, that that we're not going to. I do want to make a prediction, though. My prediction is that one day you're going to see a list of all-time great marketing blunders, and obviously New Coke will be on that list. And I think the announcement that Maker's Mark made, I think it was last week, that they're going to produce more of their product by watering it down, will be on that list. top 10
okay,
all-time
we'll
boneheaded marketing moves. I could spend a long time talking about it, but this show is not about marketing, even highly amusing marketing errors. This show is about the future, and tonight we're talking about how good it can get. And as you said, Stephen, we're building kind of off last week. Last week we took predictions about problems that humanity is facing, new problems, original problems that some of the smartest people in the world came up with and talked about on edge.org. And we had a nice list of them narrowed down. And, you know, we went through a few of them and talked about why these are things that are worth worrying about. Tonight we're taking a very different tack, and I want to point out that this is, in a sense, the first of two parts, because we're going to, at some point in the near future, have our friend George Dvorsky on. George, obviously the blogger at Sentient Developments and Mr. Big Shot over at IO9 these days, writing all kinds of really cool stuff, did a piece, I think this was about 2 weeks ago now, called, was it Best Case Scenarios for Humanity? Is that right?
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm sorry?
It's a lot of fun to read. I highly recommend it. We ought to put a link in the chat room.
Yeah, let's. I'll find that and put a link in the chat room, and we'll have George on to talk through that. So we thought tonight, instead of stealing George's thunder and spoiling that show, we would do our own best case scenarios. And these aren't necessarily best case scenarios for humanity. These are just let's take a look at some positive developments and ask this question: how good can this positive development get? If you extrapolate this trend out, if you say, here's a good thing that's happened. If this continues happening in this direction, where do we end up? How good do things get? And as a starting point for that, actually, I've got a blog post that I'm going to put in the chat room right now. And this was over on my day job blog, The Transparency Revolution. I did a piece called Don't Worry, which was actually just a kind of response to last week's show, in which I outlined some reasons why we shouldn't be worried. The first and foremost of those was what we ended last week's show on, which was that if you look at the number one answer that those 150 smartest people in the world gave to the question, what should we be worried about, was that, I mean, the distilled out number one answer was, well, maybe we shouldn't worry so much. So it wasn't just Phil saying, don't worry.
That came up about a half a dozen times. He had about a lot of these, he worried too much.
Yeah, I think it came up like 10 times altogether. After I did the final count. So, a significant percentage, and the number one answer, in a sense. So it's not just me saying don't worry. It's a preponderance, not the majority, but a preponderance of the smart people on that survey who said that. But let's take it another step. And in the piece on Transparency Revolution, I quoted a recent interview with Bill Gates and talked about some wonderful recent developments, one of which we mentioned on a show not long ago, which is that the UN's Millennium Development Goals got one of the UN's Millennium Development Goals, the one around pulling people out of poverty, out of extreme poverty, which was a goal for the year 2015, actually got met in the year 2008, that they're 7 years ahead of schedule on that one, and that it occurred completely organically. So that's great news, and if you follow the link that I just provided in the chat room, and I'll put that up on worldtransformed.com as well. I also had blogged that on Better All the Time. So this will be the rare blog post that I put everywhere. Right, I just put it on all my blogs. But it's that good. If you if you follow the link to, and not because of my writing or anything like that, but if you follow what Anil Dash wrote over at dashes.com about what Bill Gates is saying about what's going on in the world, this is incredibly encouraging, wonderful, wonderful, positive stuff. And so we'll go through a few of those, and we'll extrapolate those trends out. We'll say how good can it get, and then I think, Stephen, you and I each have some additional items to bring to the table in terms of how good can it get. Is that right?
Yeah, got a few.
All right. So you know, without any particular order, I'm just going to work through the first one that's on the list in the linked article, which is children are 1/3 less likely to die before age 5 than they were in 1990. The global childhood mortality rate for kids under 5 has dropped from 88 in 1000 in 1990 to 57 in 1000 in 2010. The global infant mortality rate for kids dying before age 1 has plunged from 61 in 1000 to 40 in 1000. And Anil goes on to write, now, any child dying is, of course, one child too many, but this is astounding progress to have made in just 20 years. It really is remarkable, and it's the sort of development that you would never hear about in the mainstream media. There's very little advertising to sell around telling a story that's good, and yet it's a story everybody wants to hear because it's so tremendously positive. And of all the horrible things that happen in the world, obviously children dying has got to be the worst. I don't know what's going to be worse than that. So this is fantastic progress. This is progress on one of the worst problems that humanity faces. Remarkable, significant progress over the past 20 years. And so the question is, how good can it get? Well, I did a little research into infant mortality rates. And Stephen, any idea what country in the world has the lowest rate?
Well, I would be cheating if I said, because I've kind of read some of what you were researching
already.
There, Phil. So I can't. But you know, I
was surprised by the answer.
Before,
I can tell you that much.
I would have guessed before you. I read your research there. Yeah, I might have said something like maybe Japan. You know. As having the lowest infant mortality.
I would have probably said Japan or Sweden, maybe, right?
Yeah.
And I know the U.S. isn't, because our infant mortality figures get skewed down because of the kind of heroic work that gets done with saving premature babies in this country, that we're kind of on the cutting edge of that science, and because we attempt to save babies that otherwise wouldn't have been attempted, it actually raises our infant mortality rate. That's one of the reasons that it's higher. There are certainly others. But the country with the lowest infant mortality rate was Monaco. Last year they had an infant mortality rate of 1.8 per 1,000. And the countries we just mentioned, Japan and Sweden, also right up there. So that's a good target to go for. Let's get the whole world looking like Monaco in that regard. And I think a midterm, near to midterm, as how good can it get, would be to see infant mortality below 1 per 1,000 throughout the developed world, in the U.S., in Europe, in Japan, all of those places where it's already hovering in the low single digits, to get it down below 1, and get it down into single digits in the developing world. Now, the end game, how good can it ultimately get? I think infant mortality becomes something that's virtually unheard of worldwide. There are certain things that just don't happen anymore much, that happens so rarely that it's kind of a big news story when it does occur. And there's actually no reason why infant mortality can't be moved into that category. We've got a ways to go, but that's the direction that we're moving in. And how good it can get is, we could live in a world where that is, I won't say completely unheard of, but virtually unheard of.
I've had this is a subject that hits close to home. I have 4 children, and
yep.
Thank God, have not had loss of children in the process of getting them here.
Right.
And that would have been pretty much 100 years ago to have, 4 healthy births where, and then all of them growing, into healthy young people and I trust into healthy adults. You know, that's without any real serious health issues. Would have been a little bit unusual, I think.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that one of my children was in NICU originally, and it was remarkable, that experience. It's very, very scary, obviously, for any parent that's experienced that. It's extremely frightening, but it's remarkable the things that they're able to do to help kids now that would have perished before. And, you know, I saw children in the NICU that were so small, and you would think, how in the world is this kid got any chance at all? And I have one of these children that, Phil, I'm going to tell you that this particular baby was not much bigger than the size of a standard light bulb.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
The tiny, tiniest little bit infant. I got to see this child, just happened in passing to see this child, couple of years ago, and she had a few developmental problems, but she was a remarkably sweet little girl, and you know, it's just amazing what medical science was able to do to save that little child, and they're getting better all the time. That is an area that's getting better all the time. So
it's a great thing to think about. It's a piece of just good news. That I think we can expect to continue to get better. I don't see any reason why that figure should go in any direction other than to continue to go in the direction it's going.
Right.
And I'm pretty psyched about that. Okay, we got a lot of these, so let's move on. Have you got one you want to share?
Okay. The past 30 years, the percentage of children who received key immunizations, such as DTP, that's I call it DIPTET. Is that right? Those kind of vaccines, those key vaccines, the incidence quadrupled, the number of children that get it. And how good can this get? Universal, including in the West, where anti-science hysteria is reducing immunization rates. That is awesome. It's immunizing. But once you get past 90%, you can afford a few foot riders. And you know what I'm saying? And so it's the problems that were epidemic in years past are, you know, unheard of. There are some things that seem to be kind of on the edge of turning. We've heard a little bit about polio, and it seemed like when I was a kid, we didn't hear about it. It was gone,
right,
practically. But that's kind of the exception. By and large, these diseases that are preventable are being prevented with immunization.
And if you think about it, you can see kind of a strong cause and effect relationship between items 1 and 2. Perhaps not so much for infant mortality, but as for childhood mortality. If the number of kids who are protected from diphtheria and tetanus, not to mention measles and smallpox, for heaven's sake, which still occurs in some places at some times, and all these other dreaded diseases that have been particularly hard on children over the years. This is one of the reasons why that kids are surviving. It's because they're getting immunized, and it is a problem that there is a kind of hysterical, superstitious dread around immunizations, that there's a whole kind of counterculture that's anti-immunization in the West. It's big in the U.S., I think bigger in Europe and Australia and some other places, and it's had some impact in the developing world, which is just a terrible shame that people in the developing world get afraid to use immunization. So that is a piece of it. That is the only piece of it that can slow us down in things getting as good as it can get. But ultimately, I trust that people are going to make rational decisions about this in the long run. And the rational decision is you don't want your child getting measles. You don't want your child getting any of these diseases. And vaccination is preventing that. This is kind of like the empirical proof that vaccination works. When you think about the first two items on our list here, 4 times as many kids getting immunizations and far fewer children dying in childhood. I'm going to go. I'm going to call that one a cause and effect thing, at least to some extent. There's other reasons that that kids are living. There's better nutrition. There's better quality of life in a lot of ways. Better cleaner water. Just a whole host of things playing into it. But this is a part of it for sure.
You know, one thing, a personal decision we made as parents, Phil, was instead of loading up the kids with all the vaccines at one time, which tends to be done, and I believe more for the convenience of the doctor than anything else, but we would just, we'd have we would just tell the doctor, no, you can't give them all these are the vaccines that you want to give today, you can't give today. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Right.
And, we would tend to space them out just for the purpose of not allowing our kids to feel like crap the 2 or 3 days following vaccinations, which I was very young, obviously, when I was being vaccinated, but I do have some memories of, of being loaded up with vaccines and feeling pretty cruddy for a little bit. That's something I'm not necessarily suggesting that everyone do that. Maybe the key vaccine your kid needs, you have delayed a week and he needed it that week. I don't know. So I'm not advocating that in any way. That's just a personal decision that my wife and I made. And our kids are all caught up in their vaccines now and are doing well. So anyway.
Well, I think it's an important consideration. I mean, you think about how it's going to make you feel the next day, and also – getting a bunch of shots is a real drag. I mean, especially if you're a little kid, getting a shot is a scary thing. And having it 4 or 5 of them is just, if that can be avoided, if that can be worked around, I think that's, there's some quality of life issues there too.
Well, maybe so. And then the other school of thought is it's like a Band-Aid, just rip it off and give them all the shots at once. They have one lousy day and then they don't have to worry about it after that. I don't know. It's a parent's
personal choice. Yep.
It's very, very personal choice kind of thing. So,
anyway. If it was up to me, I would never rip a Band-Aid off. They would just fall off naturally. But that's me. unlike most of you listening, I've just never cared for pain. There it is. I don't like pain. So call me weird.
You're weird that way, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm just an outlier, I suppose. Okay, so where does that get us to the next one? I mentioned already at the introduction part of the show, the percentage of people in the world living on less than $1.25 per day has been cut in half since 1990, ahead of the schedule of the Millennium Development Goals, which hope to reach this target by 2015. Again, one of the best pieces of news to emerge in the past couple of years. I don't think anyone noticed it in 2008. I think it took a few years for the data to come in, and I think it probably took even longer than that for somebody to go, hey, wait a minute. Did we notice that we beat the Millennium Development Goal? I really think it was at that level that somebody was cataloging all this, and they said, wait a second. We beat a goal here, partly because it happened organically. The UN set these goals, but then they didn't put any mechanisms in place to make them happen, which is a kind of a typical bureaucratic sort of a thing to do. We'll set a really lofty goal, and it surprises me that the UN hasn't given themselves a little more press for this, taking some credit on this. Hey, look how well we did on our goal. But the bottom line here is that economic development throughout the world, economic development, particularly in Asia, has an awful lot to do with why this happened. And we've already discussed the fact on multiple occasions that more people have been lifted out of poverty in the last 20 years than in all of prior human history. And that is the proof of that. When you look at this number, the number of people living on less than $1.25 per day, which is astoundingly poor when you think about it. I mean, it's hard to imagine what kind of life that actually means, has been cut in half. Now, what's going to happen? How good can it get? Well, I would say that over the next 20 years, just double that time period, we can expect to see the number of people living on that same amount halved again, and maybe once again. I think we'll just, per abundance, we'll just continue moving at that rate. We'll continue moving in that direction, and I think the rate at which that occurs will probably increase. Long term, you can say, well, there will be nobody living on $1.25 a day or less. That would be fine. But I actually think that this one takes us farther even than that. I think the how good can this get measurement here is that the measure of living on $1.25 a day or less becomes meaningless. Because what happens in the long term is we have universal access around the world to the ability to produce your own goods, to the ability to acquire whatever food you need, to the ability to have shelter, clothing, nutrition, medical care, information, all the factors that we think of as contributing to quality of life. And whether there's a dollar amount attached to that or not is completely beside the point. Everybody becomes middle class or better simply by virtue of the fact that whatever you need becomes available. This is what post-scarcity is all about. And I think that the achievement of that Millennium Development Goal is a good indicator that we're moving rapidly towards post-scarcity. And I think that ultimately we'll get to the point where there's no such definition. I mean, the definition of poverty would be somebody who doesn't have access to the technology that makes it possible to produce your own goods, to produce your own food. And that ultimately, in the same way that internet technology is beginning to touch just about every life on the planet, the full realization of that technology, which is the turning of the transformation, I should say, of handling of materials, the transformation of all goods in addition to services becoming an information technology, becomes realized worldwide, and poverty ceases to exist completely. That's how good it can get.
And there's a secondary impact. When someone only earns $1.25 a day, Phil, they spend their whole day, I'm sure, just doing whatever they can do to get enough to eat to survive to the next day. That's, you know, they spend their day just surviving, you know. Whereas once you rise out of that, you can spend your day doing things that might actually, you know, in some way contribute beyond just, you know, your own requirements. You can begin to contribute to your own community once your basic needs are met. And I think that the entire world gets better the more people move out of poverty, and people can contribute to one another once their basic needs are met. And that just, you know, it's not happening when you're starving, like I'm sure that people that are having to make do with $1.25 a day are. So
yeah, I mean, once you get out of that basic survival mode, you can not only contribute beauty to the world, you can do creative, interesting, wonderful things, which is nice. But yeah, you're in you've got a lot more leverage to materially make the world better. People who aren't worried about surviving are in a much better position to help other people, which it's really hard to do if you're just trying to keep yourself or your wife and your children from starving to death. There's just no bandwidth for helping the couple next,
else.
You know, the family next door. Exactly.
It matters not at all what your gifts are when you're earning $1.25 a day.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you might have the mind of someone who could become a brilliant chemist, but it's not happening when you're worried about, you know, where do I get the calories to keep from dying today. And
right.
So that's, anyway, and you know, if fewer and fewer people are like that, then perhaps there'll be more people contributing to the effort to get other people beyond that. So
I think Gandhi said that
virtuous cycle,
that poverty is the ultimate form of oppression. It's the final and ultimate form of oppression. And what we're talking about is people being lifted out of poverty. We're talking about people being liberated. We're talking about people being granted basic freedom that they didn't have before. So it's just a wonderful trend that I think is going to continue to move in a wonderful direction.
Absolutely. Okay. Next thing, number of tuberculosis the number of deaths from tuberculosis has been cut 40% in the past 20 years. That's huge, isn't it, Phil? I mean, tuberculosis, TB, has been something that has been with us for a long, long time, and the fact that it's been cut is actually a little bit surprising, Phil, because I've heard of some recent cases of tuberculosis within the United States. It appeared that we were getting a handle on, and then lately we've heard of a few cases. My thought is that maybe it's just some outlying cases, but it's not coming back. That's my hope.
Well, I know that the U.S. rate is 3.4 cases per 100,000 people, and that it's lower at that rate than it has been historically. So, as a country, we're actually doing pretty well on tuberculosis, and the world's doing well on tuberculosis. So those are both great measures. I actually meant to – I saw a link earlier today, and I meant to save it, and I don't know where it is now because I was going to put that in the chat room. It was just one of those interesting coincidences. I guess the first new treatment for tuberculosis to be introduced in 50 years was just approved, and I don't have the details on it, but it just goes to show you that we can continue moving in the right direction on this one, that there's still progress to be made, even as – huge progress has already been made. How?
Well, you know, that's interesting to me that we have a new treatment for tuberculosis. If we only have 3.4 cases per 100,000, then you could make the argument that there's not as pressing of a need for that as for pushing research in other directions. I would guess, Phil, not having read the story at all, potential treatment came about just from general research, or maybe researching in some other way that had the happy accident of finding something that would help TB. I didn't
read the story, but that's entirely possible. Serendipity.
Yeah,
somebody looked at some results from something that was being a medication that was being trialed for something entirely different, and said, "Wait a minute, this might help tuberculosis." And it was worth doing some research into that. And boom, you've got a new treatment for tuberculosis. I think that is entirely possible. So how good can it get? Well, I think let's cut 40% again. Let's cut 80% again. I think that's entirely possible. Although one thing I wonder about, Brian Wong over on Next Big Future is always railing against coal as an energy form. And he talks about the death rate in mines. He talks about the what it does to the environment. There's a lot to be said in favor of coal in terms of you can get a lot of energy per pound of coal. But there's a lot to be said against it. And I wonder if one of the things that can be said against it is that would burning coal be one of the contributors to this? I would imagine it probably is.
Yeah. Burning coal, there's just a lot of problems with burning coal.
Yeah.
And we burn our share of it here in the United States, but we're amateurs by comparison to China, which is coming online with lots and lots of new coal burning power plants. They need electricity. Don't blame them for wanting the electricity. I'm fond of my electricity, but perhaps there's other ways of doing it. I'm thinking nuclear is the way to go, and I'm hopeful that China adopts more nuclear power plants, but we'll see.
Or we move towards solar, whatever.
Things that
don't mess with people's lungs, I think, would be good. And I think it's very interesting that this big drop has occurred while China has been pouring it on in terms of how much coal they're burning. So it's possible that we'll see bad results from that, and that this number slows down a little bit in the coming years. Or it could be that tuberculosis treatments have been so effective that in spite of the increase in coal burning, the number is still going down. Remains to be seen, but it can get very good. I'd like to see the worldwide rate get to where the U.S. rate is now, below the current U.S. rate of 3.4 cases per 100,000 people, and all of that, of course, just towards an end game, ultimately, of eliminating tuberculosis completely. All right. Who started that one? Is it my turn or your turn?
I did. So you're
okay.
Up.
Okay. Here's a sweet one, okay? And you don't hear about this, I guess, because things have gotten so good in this regard. The consumption of ozone-depleting substances has been cut 85% globally in the last 30 years. Now, I remember when I was a younger man, quarter of a century or so ago, we were supposed to be dreadfully worried about ozone-depleting substances. And I'm saying we were supposed to be, but perhaps with good reason we were supposed to be. This is, the ozone's a really important thing, and there is tremendous environmental damage that can be caused by having the ozone depleted. So ozone-depleting substances have been cut 85% in the last 30 years, over the time frame since that I was talking about. This is not this goes to show you what a hard time good news has in the media.
We are wired to accept bad news, Phil, and
yeah.
we as a species are ready to hear. We're ready to hear how everything's going to crap. And
yeah,
so,
after all the time
you know, you're not
going to
hear
worrying,
that. Yeah.
After all the time we spent worrying about that 20, 25 years ago, shouldn't we have a big victory party now on ozone depleting substances? You know, that we've made such fantastic progress, and instead it's just not mentioned. No one thinks about it, and nobody knows this fact, which is a really, really remarkable fact. How good can it get? Well, I'm going to say we can get a 99% reduction, but the number is pretty darn good now. You know, we're closing in on how good it can possibly get. We're 15% away from eliminating it altogether. So, this is one where we're kind of on the home stretch, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Chlorofluorocarbons is what I remember it being.
Yeah, that's right. And the spray can.
That was what it was. And I was a youngster when it was all over the news. Seemed like every night, you know, Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw or somebody was on the news talking about, you know, how we got this hole in the ozone layer that's getting bigger and bigger, and here's why. You know, our hairspray and our refrigerants are just killing us. Time for a party. Absolutely. We ought to throw one.
Yeah, I think it's time for a big we conquered the ozone problem party, and we can celebrate getting that UN development goal too. You know what?
Yeah.
When's the next Future Day? These are the things that people should be thinking about that get mentioned on Future Day. We should talk about all the fantastic accomplishments that have been made that are making our future brighter. We'll remember that when is it? It's next month, isn't it? Sometime.
Are they having it
again this year? I don't know.
I think it comes every year. So.
Yeah, I need to get caught up. Find out when the next Future Day is, and we're gonna you know, this is our celebration. We're all gonna party around some of these huge things that have happened. Okay, so let's keep moving. We got more of these to talk about.
Okay, let's see. Well, Phil, are we to our? Oh no. We got a couple more that we need to get to before we can talk about our own. Okay, percentage of urban dwellers living in slums globally has been cut from 46.2% to 32.7% in the last 20 years. And, that is pretty good. I mean, so these people aren't leaving cities to get out of the slums. They're still in cities, but, they're moving on up in a way. Which raises an interesting question: when is your urban dwelling cease to be a slum? When do you cross that mark? I'm sure there's some. If you drilled down into it, you probably could get the exact definition of what is a slum. But that's a really good question.
It's got to have something to do with basic infrastructure, I would think. Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Do you have sewage work?
You know, below ground sewage, above ground. Do you have access to electricity? I mean, those kind of questions, I'm sure.
And you know what else it might be is how many people living per square foot, something like that.
Yeah.
Probably when you combine some factors around electricity, sewage, running water, waste disposal, and how many people are packed into a particular space. Also, maybe availability of basic services like police and fire department and medical. There's an awful lot that contributes to whether you're in a neighborhood or whether you're in a slum, I come to think of it.
This is tied, Phil, to the what we were talking about earlier about the $1.25 a day kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because, you know, those numbers keep getting better and better. It's no coincidence that this number is getting better and better. If you're not subsisting on a small amount of money like that, then your surroundings start getting better. You know, you're no longer in a slum. all of a sudden you start insisting on particular infrastructure and you're able to provide it, through taxes or whatever. You know, a person that's earning $1.25, you can't tax that person. There's no tax to go after. So there's no money to go after there. So obviously those statistics are tied together.
There's a huge relationship between the two. And it really is a great question that you ask, which is, did people move or did people improve their neighborhoods? You know, that's the ultimate question about what happened when we went from almost half of the people living in cities were in slums to right around a third of the people living in cities are living in slums, which is a great progress to make. You know, how good can that get? Let's get it down to 10% or less. And one of the big drivers of this can very well be that material abundance and technology are making it possible to make improvements that would have been much more expensive earlier. And
right.
I go back to Cory Doctorow's book, Makers, where people are living in the squatter village, but they're living in relative luxury just because they're able to make such good use of material that is not considered to be of tremendous value. Obviously, that's fiction, but I bet some of that is at play here. I have a feeling that the availability of greater material resources through a move in the direction of post-scarcity has a big part to play in this.
You know, this is, this concept is tied to another issue. A lot of times there's been this idea, perhaps in earlier times with environmentalism, that cities were a bad thing and that urban sprawl was a bad thing and all that. In fact, cities are the greenest possible way for the most number of people to live on this earth.
Right.
When people live in cities, you're not driving a car, an hour to get to your job. You're
right.
Probably taking a public transportation a couple blocks down the street or bicycle or whatever to get to your
yep.
job. And it's just a greener way to live. And so I'm glad that these people, it would appear that that they're moving out of the slums or the slums are getting better, but not necessarily deurbanizing. The cities are continuing to prosper. So good things all around.
Good stuff. Absolutely. Well, let's move on. I've got one. I think have we exhausted the list from the Transparency Revolution post? I think we have.
I think we have. That was the last one, I believe.
Okay, so let me move on to one that I made note of over on the World Transform page just a few days ago. And this is a really interesting story. You see this floating around about the bionic man.
Which I think was a little bit bogus. I don't like that title for that article, but I'll tell you. You probably
okay, what would you call it?
Well, it's an android. I mean, a bionic man to me is a cyborg. It's a human person that has lost limbs or something like that, and those limbs have been replaced with limbs that are practically mechanical or computerized or whatever, but that are practically indistinguishable from natural limbs. I'm thinking of Steve Austin. I'm not thinking of a robot.
Yeah, this is what I think. I'm pretty sure that's why they called it, why they used the term bionic, because they referred to the fact that Rex, which is the name they gave to this composite robot that they built. It really is a robot or an android. You're absolutely right. They referred to Rex as the $1 million bionic man. Now, in one sense, bionic is the correct term to use because he's made of bionic parts. He's made of parts that are intended to be used with a living organism. But you're right that it's incorrect to call this entity bionic because there's no guy that this stuff has all been attached to. It's 60-70% of a human being, but the missing organic 30% isn't there. That would be bionic, right? If the other 30% were there.
Research, Phil, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to figure out how do we you know, how do we piece all these parts together and so that they can work together so that when we do install them on a man, you know, they work, you know, in a way that's great, you know. If Steve Austin needs both legs replaced, you know, so that he can run 60 miles an hour, it's very important that right leg works well with left leg, right?
Right.
And so that's I think that's part of what they're learning there is how to get all the parts to work together.
Right. And, well, the thing it put me in mind of, and this is what I wrote over on Facebook on the World Transform page, is every now and then you'll see these studies that someone does around what if you tried to build a whole car out of parts purchased from an auto parts store. It can be done.
Yeah.
And people have done it from time to time, which is a very interesting exercise. It's not a smart way to get a car because you're going to get this odd hodgepodge of a car, for one thing, and it's going to cost you about 5, 6, 7 times too much buying the parts a la carte. It's just not smart business. You know, the factory where they're manufactured is dealing in a much greater volume of them, and it's assembling them, and you know, it's just a much smarter way to buy a car is to buy a car preassembled, not to make it from spare parts. But those studies are indicative of how well resourced we are around parts. The fact that there are so many car parts available that you can build a car from spare parts tells you how resilient our infrastructure is around automobiles. Just about anything that goes wrong with a car can be fixed. Just about anything that breaks can be replaced, by and large. You can fix a car. And to take that same principle and start to apply it to a human body is astounding. That is absolutely one of the coolest things that could ever happen. That you can get to 60 or 70% of a human body tells me that they've probably got the 60 to 70 easiest parts, okay, 60 to 70% easiest parts, and the rest is going to be pretty heavy sledding, you know, nervous systems and brains and some of the vital organs that currently can't be made mechanically. Big work lies ahead, but the fact that we've gotten more than halfway there, I think is extremely encouraging. And when you ask how good can it get, the answer is we can get to 100%. We can get to the point where, like with a car, anything that is broken can be replaced. Ultimately, we'll get to the point where anything that is broken can be regrown, or that an entire body can be replaced by a whole new body if needed. I think that
we've had this discussion before, Phil, and the discussion was this. Do we get Luke Skywalker's, you know, mechanical hand that's indistinguishable from his other hand, you know, before a blaster bolt goes through it, but, you know, that works just as well and that he can actually feel with it and everything. Do we get that hand first, or do we get the ability to grow back the hand?
Right.
I'm of the opinion that we get the ability to grow the hand back before we have the technology make a bionic hand that is as perfect as what we saw in Empire Strikes Back. That's just an opinion of mine.
I don't know. You know, the tricky thing about that hand in the Empire Strikes Back was that obviously it had feeling. And yeah. I think that we'll have one that works just about as well as an actual biological hand before we'll have you can grow one back. But I don't think it'll have feel. You know what I mean? It's like, I see this as a very close race, personally.
My son had an interesting thought about that. We were watching Empire Strikes Back about 3 or 4 months ago, and I just mentioned that. I said, you know, I wonder which would be first, that or that. And his answer, I thought, was pretty smart. He said, yeah, I think we'll have the mechanical hand first, but it'll serve as a framework for growing a biological hand.
Oh, there you go. Exactly.
So, you know, it'll be a growth medium inside it so that, you know, pretty soon the mechanical hand just you shed it in favor of the regrown biological hand underneath. So
would he have an interest in co-hosting ever? Or?
Yeah, I'm going to retire and put him in my seat here.
He's got some good ideas. I think we.
Yeah, that's a pretty good idea.
We might need to use it. You and he do a couple of shows together without without me slowing you down, huh? But
right.
Yeah, well, that, no, that's a. Go ahead.
I was going to launch into my next one, but I'll let you finish your thought.
No, go ahead. I was just about to say we've got a few more to cover, so let's keep moving.
Okay. Okay. Chlorofluorocarbons was we mentioned. How we're eating away the ozone layer, and now they're gone. That was rampant back in the 70s and 60s and before. Leaded gasoline and the effect that it was having putting lead in our environment. You know, that problem has been solved by and large in the United States, and it's continued to it has been solved in the United States, and in most other countries in the world, it's leaded gasoline is a thing of the past as well. So that's another thing we ought to have a party over, but you'll never hear about it in normal media. So.
Absolutely. Well, and how good can that one get? I guess it's just that stuff doesn't exist anymore. How close are we to that? That's another one we're closing in on, huh?
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that it was for inner city children. Children are apparently most susceptible to the problems that lead can cause regarding developmental problems and lowered IQs and all kinds of anger issues and all kinds of things that was bad about lead being in an environment. We've gotten rid of the leaded paints. We've gotten rid of the leaded gasoline, and so by and large, our children in this country are not being affected by lead like they once were, and that's just a wonderful thing.
Good can it get? We'll just stop poisoning children anywhere with lead. That will be
No lead anywhere, particularly a kid's going to be.
Okay, I've got several more, but they're kind of a set. So do you have any more that you want to do?
Go ahead. Just roll through your sets, Bill, and if I can contribute, I will.
Okay, so you've exhausted your list?
No, I got one more or two, but we'll do this organically. You just shoot through it.
Okay, all right. So here's I was saving this one for last. And do you remember back in the day, back in 08, when we were giving out the Fast Forward Radio, at that time, coffee mugs? And we were announcing how we were going to, happily give them to any presidential candidate who would come on board with a fast forward radio speculist friendly agenda. Well, I am pleased to announce that President Obama, as of the State of the Union address yesterday, has finally earned his fast forward radio, or we'll now make it a world transformed coffee mug. I don't think he has up to this point, but he did last night by mentioning 3D printers in the State of the Union address. Thank you, Mr. President. I think that is extremely exciting to hear that. I'm always excited to hear it anywhere in the mainstream media, but to hear the President of the United States talk about 3D printing on the in the State of the Union address is I just personally feel validated. Okay, I feel like we're not doing the show in vain. Somehow this is all it's all getting through somehow, and it makes me think yes, we actually are moving towards these things that the future that we've been describing is one that we're going to get to, and it makes me wonder how good can it get. Well, I've got some increasingly speculistic things that we might look for. So here's my list. How long before we hear a president favorably mention self-driving cars in the State of the Union address? And I'm going on the assumption that we haven't heard that to date. Is that right?
Correct. We've not heard a national leader in this country. And by that I mean, head of the House, head of the Senate, the president. We've not heard any of those individuals mention self-driving cars, to my knowledge.
Yeah, and I think we'll hear it probably in campaign rhetoric at some point, but eventually we'll get a favorable mention of self-driving cars in the State of the Union address. Then we'll know that idea has really truly begun to arrive. Eventually we're going to hear a president favorably, and this is important, favorably mention life extension in the State of the Union address, because I think there have been references to people living too long, unfortunately, in State of the Union addresses before, kind of looking at it the wrong way. But a favorable mention of life extension the way we talk about it, what we mean by it, I think we're going to get there. I think we'll hear that one day. After that, we're going to hear the President of the United States someday soon favorably mention the notion of post-scarcity. Maybe not use the term post-scarcity, but if President Obama is talking about 3D printers today. President whoever in 2016 or 2024 is going to talk about the fact that we're moving to a post-scarcity world in whatever language the media has adopted to talk about that by that time, or the political infrastructure has adopted. And that leaves only one thing, as far as I'm concerned, which is that eventually, one day, we're going to hear the President of the United States favorably mention the technological singularity in the State of the Union address. What do you think, Stephen?
You know what I think? I think it'll be about a month and a half after the technological singularity.
By then, the president will be a robot.
I'm telling you, Phil, they lead from behind. And you know, I'm not just talking about present leadership. I always, it seems, these guys are reactionary rather than, you know, thinking forward. But that's, you know, that's just me being a little bit cynical. Sorry.
Well, you know, I'm with you 100%. But even leading from behind, we finally got 3D printers mentioned. So the rest is coming. You know,
it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
The
thing that I was going to mention, if you rolled through your stuff just then, I was going to say the empowerment of the individuals.
Right.
And that's exactly what we're talking about when we talk about things like 3D printing and life extension and all these other things. It's, you know, in the beginning of the book, The Makers, you mentioned that a little earlier, Phil, it sort of sets the stage for, you know, the rest of the book by talking about these corporations at the beginning. I think Kodak/Duracell had joined up, you know. They were trying to survive as a large corporation, as Kodak Duracell. And so they were falling behind. They just could not keep up with small groups, you know, maybe a couple of guys in their garage. And so it immediately moves, basically the emphasis of the book then moves to a couple of guys in the garage and pretty much stays with them until the end of the book. It's and I see that's kind of the way the world is going to move. We will see innovation on the level of what used to require big corporations move. It seemed like for a time we had innovation in the garages, and then innovation moved to the large companies as they were built up. But I think innovation is going to spread back out again because individuals are nimbler, you know, and if they have the power to do these remarkable things, because we can do more and more with less and less, then you're gonna see the big companies being outmaneuvered by these, you know, two or three guys working together to do amazing things.
Couldn't agree more. Innovation is one of the superpowers that all of us sexy immortal billionaires will be wielding quite happily, I think, in the very near future. Okay, well, that is going to exhaust our list. I will say that in the chat room they also mentioned another wonderful thing that's happened is that no zombie apocalypse. So we're very pleased.
we want that.
To have had that development. How good can it get? I think we'll have zero zombie apocalypses, and I'll go on the record with that. All right, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
What a Sight by Elkin is our
What a sight or a fight?
What a Sight.
Okay, What a Sight by Elkin. All right. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Great talking with you as always. We will be back again next week at the regular time. We've got some great shows coming up. As I mentioned, we're going to have George Dvorsky on soon. We're going to get our friend Stuart Seligman back on to talk about putting together your own World Transformed group. So please be with us next time. And until next time, live to see it.
Maybe late, no disgrace, why do you have to crave? Simple taste, send you off to some obnoxious place. Must embrace, some reprieve, it's like a different place. Not too late, miss the boat, but we'll still catch the train. Thank you. can I?